Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
Accessed entry 565.JB1921, certificate number 38221. The hand of God.
Y por eso están viniendo más por aquí.
Paulinho asociándose con Leo Messi. Va a llegar Jordi Alba al límite. El centro. Gol.
Now, whenever I think of the hand of God, the first thing I think of is Margaret Thatcher.
How so?
Well, she just ruled England with an iron fist, and an iron fist and the hand of God are more or less the same thing in my religious cosmology.
I imagine the foot of God stomping on Margaret Thatcher like a Terry Gilliam
and
animation.
Now something completely different.
So Margaret Thatcher is your God. Got it.
No, not my God, but a God, I think.
Which is great for a former food scientist. Does that mean Dennis is a god?
Dennis the Menace?
Dennis Thatcher.
Oh, Dennis Thatcher.
Her long-suffering husband.
Not a god. Spouse of a god.
Consort.
No, I do not think Margaret Thatcher was a god. I came of age during the Reagan and Thatcher years. I mean, came of age as a political person. And so I grew up as a teenager despising them both with the kind of like unshakable conviction that only a teenager can have, and remember Thatcher primarily as a
subject of mean Elvis Costello songs.
Yeah. And a giant puppet in Genesis music video.
Exactly. That was actually her. A lot of people don't know that.
It was really her. The rest were puppets.
She played herself. She was doing the early Andy Serkis kind of a thing.
Do you remember the Falklands War? You must. You are old enough to have remembered or to have been conscious, cognizant.
I do. I remember I think of it as when I think of the Falklands War, I'm picturing like a Time or a Newsweek cover, you know, because those would show up on the coffee table and it would be like, war. And I would ask my parents where the Falklands are, and they would explain that, well, you know, it doesn't really
they
matter.
Don't really exist.
It doesn't really Falklands. Matter. This is a proxy war that could. That could lead to, you know, it's much like the way we're thinking about Ukraine today, you know, like what if this does turn into some actual NATO Russian shooting war? Because, you know, the Eastern Bloc was very quick to defend Argentina against this kind of imperialist aggression from across the Atlantic.
Yeah, although weird because Argentina had a fascist
military dictator that was just like waving and being like, hey, sorry, the economy collapsed. Look over here. We're going to, we got a battleship now.
Right. And, you know, during that period, Operation Condor, which was the CIA's...
The Jackie Chan movie?
The Jackie Chan movie, which was based on a true story of the CIA trying to overthrow all leftist movements in South America and replace them with super, super bad military dictatorship.
Isn't a condor a big unwieldy throwback that's going extinct? That's not the best metaphor for your Latin American skullduggery, right?
Yeah, and the word condor appears in a lot of Cold War era spy stories and spy magazines. So it was, you know, condors were really in the news.
Condor Man was huge. Everybody had a Condor Man lunchbox.
But yeah, the war over the Falklands.
Or Las Malvinas.
Las Malvinas.
As they say.
Yeah, no, you'll be hearing a lot of bad Spanish from me in this episode.
Yes.
It was a foundational moment for me as a political teen. It produced one of my favorite Pink Floyd records, although a lot of people deride it as the first Roger Waters solo record, The Final Cut, an album almost entirely about the Falklands War.
You will only listen to the you never want to hear another Pink Floyd album in case you find that's not as good as The Final Cut.
The Final Cut is a really good record, and I won't hear any talk against it. Although Pink Floyd is one of the bands I've listened to all their albums.
It's a concept album about the Falklands War?
There's a lot of Falklands content. It's a concept record about the decline of England. England.
That's what you have shipbuilding for. By Elvis Costello. It's the same kind of elegy for England, but it's got a smooth Chet Baker trumpet solo.
Yeah, that's why, you know, the Yards would still be open on the Klein if only it wasn't for the Japanese being so good at building ships. Although that's not the term used in the lyrics.
No,
so there was a little bit of racism.
And that was the kind of racism that was okay back then.
At the time, anti-Japanese racism.
I love the Japanese, but they shouldn't be buying the Empire State Building.
I know, 1982.
That was such a weird news cycle.
So if you recall, just for those of our listeners who were not yet born during the Falklands War, it was one of the many dumb wars of the 20th century. And the 20th and so far early 21st century, it was especially dumb because the Falkland Islands are all the way down at the southern tip of South America, really quite obviously part of the archipelago of islands shared between Chile and Argentina that are South American.
But it's certainly closer to South America than, say, it is to
England,
Wales.
Right. But the Falklands themselves and a few other groups of islands, the South Georgia and the South Sandwich Islands, which mostly, I mean, a lot of those are just atolls. They're very far south and they're very cold in winter. But they've been crown colonies of the United Kingdom since 1841. And they had a small population, but a devotedly UK population.
Not much. Like, I don't even know how many, more culturally or ethnically Argentine people would have even been there when the first British settlers arrived. Probably negligible.
Right? None, really. There's a harsh climate, not a lot of reason to be there. But
So the degree that anybody's there, they wish to be British.
Yeah, the islands were settled primarily during the whaling era as way stations for whaling ships, and they became somewhat strategic in the 19th century, just the age of sail, and this was a place that I mean, it's like Ascension Island. I mean, the United Kingdom had a lot of colonial possessions that were just places to take on fresh water. But no, there's no value to them, but they're...
Hey.
No, let me take that back.
Wow.
They're really, really valuable.
I wish they were underwater, says John of the Falkland Islands.
They're really valuable. That's a terrible blurb. Now, because they've been, since the Falklands War, they've been very improved.
And now since the Falklands War, also someone has heard of them, which would not have been the case in, say, 1979.
What's interesting is that in the 60s, the UK Foreign Office really had no interest in the Falkland Islands and, in fact, considered them kind of a liability. Like, this was the era in the mid 60s, this was the era of the end of colonialism in a lot of parts of the world. And the UK was shedding its many colonial possessions. There were lots of revolutions happening around the world. And the last thing the Foreign Office thought it needed was the Falkland Islands, which were a thorn in Argentina's side and had been for a long time, just because how dare they, your typical kind of nationalist.
I've talked to Argentine people even today about this, and they're just gobsmacked that anyone would say that the Falklands are not Argentine. Yeah. And I'm like, but there's no real Argentinian people there, right?
Never has.
And they're like,
been.
Look at a map. Look at a map. Like that's kind of the level of discourse. So even people who would not think of themselves as allied with the kind of the rightist jingoism of the Falklands War, from Argentina's point of view, they still take it as a given.
It's still a big issue in Argentina. You're absolutely right. And I think it always was a much bigger issue in Argentina than it was in the UK, where most people couldn't have pointed to the Falklands.
They were so angry.
And so in the mid-60s, the Foreign Office actually said internally, let's just give the Falklands to Argentina.
Well, that would have saved a lot of trouble.
It would have.
Who was against this? James Bond?
The people who lived in the Falkland Islands.
Right.
Who naturally, as a far-flung territory, felt very patriotic about their...
More Catholic than the Pope?
Yeah, their British
More British than the Queen?
And so they said, no, you know, we don't want to be ceded to Argentina.
Well, I mean, it's understandable. If somebody asked me, hey, your home is actually closer to Canada than it is to Washington, D.C., would you want to be part of Canada? I would say yes. But if somebody said, hey, your home is closer to Siberia than it is to Washington, D.C., would you like to be part of Russia? You know, I wouldn't be eager to make that swap.
Right.
You can't just go based on geographic proximity.
Yeah, exactly. You can't say that Vancouver Island, which is very close to the United States, should be part of the United States, although I firmly believe it should.
I remember when the Argentine person tried this line of argument, like, what if there was just some island off the coast of America and it was like a foreign possession? And I was like,
you mean Bermuda?
That happens all the time. like, let me show you a map of the Caribbean. Are you saying we should invade, not Grenada, it's independent. Are you saying we should invade Curacao? Because I'm kind of into that.
Well, Curacao's all the way down by South America. It shouldn't be Dutch.
What's closer to us and not independent?
Cuba.
That's right.
And the United Nations had a lot of strong feelings during this period about the kind of anti-colonial.
This was the time when
time.
All the big European empires were being dismantled and everybody got their own flag and anthem and less awful name, and they got to join the UN.
And the Argentinians were not, and this is under our good friend of the show, Juan Perón.
Every omnibus from now on will mention Juan Perón mm-hmm. once.
And Isabel Perón, his wife and subsequent leader of Argentina. They did not want to compromise a deal.
I guess I may have misspoken on the last show when I said that, you know, now that I think about it, I think the woman in that movie does say they made a musical about her, but I think she was talking about Isabel Perón, not Ava. I don't know. This is, couldn't be less interesting or relevant to the Falklands or world soccer.
So many great movies about the Perones, I don't even know where to start. You should do a thing where you watch every movie about the Perón family.
Let's watch all those movies that Ava acted in when she was Ava Duarte, you know, just weird kind of gaucho romances.
See, this would be a great, like, film festival. You should do film festivals. Ken Jennings film festivals.
We're going to watch Riefenstahl mountain climbing movies and Ava Duarte gaucho romances and nothing else.
Well, so it becomes like a obviously... It's very contentious, and for the most part, the UK government does not want the Falklands. They don't want to offend the... they don't want to... it's a political football, right? They don't want to give fuel to the kind of nationalistic side in Parliament that is looking for any reason to... scream and yell about the decline and fall.
What if you throw money at the people and relocate them? Like they do when like some Irish island no longer has a sustainable turning point population.
So there were a lot of attempts to do this. They said, well, wait, what if we...
Like penguins.
What if we did a lease option where we ceded the island to Argentina, but leased it back for a period.
So that's it's a Hong Kong situation where it becomes the next generation's problem.
Right. Or what if we introduce more Argentine culture
yeah.
in the form of like, you know, importing some delicious like burned meat on swords.
You can watch
dancing.
That, watch that Disney movie where Donald Duck does the samba and the tango.
Yeah, exactly. And then
if you show your kids that often enough, they will want to be Argentine.
Gradually, we'll create a kind of mixed culture here, a blended culture that's less just a bunch of descendants of UK whalers and more a
inbred bounty mutineers and whoever lives there.
You know, let's do a thing like that. The UK granted the like oil and gas concessions exclusively to an Argentine oil company. Like a lot of attempts to mollify the situation and basically get the Falkland Islands off of the books. Mm-hmm. But the islanders themselves, who were not an especially rebellious population, they were people that were essentially
farmers or something.
Yeah, they were farming sheep and they were extracting oil from herring, but as
a hobby. But that's just for fun on Saturday nights.
It became a thing that the UK just couldn't find a way to divest itself without getting
killed on property taxes.
Yeah, screamed at. But also Argentina was very unwilling to yield, you know, unwilling to make a compromise because the idea of the Falklands being super important to their national wholeness was another political football. And after Isabel Perón, the government of Argentina, starting in the mid-70s or the early mid-70s, the government of Argentina was a succession of military dictatorships.
Each deposing the next.
Yeah.
Some guy with more gold braid on his shoulder and on his hat.
Exactly.
Walks up to the balcony, pushes the other guy off.
The classic sort of image of the banana republic dictator with all the braid.
Except you can't go grow bananas down there.
Nope, it's too far south.
What would you call that? What is that?
It's the burned meat dictators.
Burned steak republic.
The whole era of Argentine government was called the National Reorganizational Process or the National Reorganization Process.
Someday we will refer to this period in American history as the National Reorganization Process.
Or the shortened form was El Proceso.
It's a process.
It's just the process.
You can't argue about any of the details of how many of your spouses are disappearing in stadiums. It's a big process.
And as you say, this was the era of the dirty war, the desaparecidos, Thank you. Desaparecidos.
Very nice. Muy bien. Muy bien, John.
Desaparecidos.
Muy bien, Juan. Did you ever have a Spanish language class name? Muy bien, Paco.
I did not ever take Spanish.
It doesn't show, I'll tell you that.
Because I am probably the last generation of kids that were told that French was the language of the educated.
I blame Julia Child, right?
Yeah.
By the time Sesame Street got more cultural hegemony than Julia Child, that, you know, that was the death knell for French, but you were just a year before that.
What's interesting is that I did record a song for a musician by the name of Denver Daly, who was in the band
Desaparecidos
with Connor Oberst. Denver Daly was his his bandmate, and he ended up making a record.
Is this before Connor Oberst was in Ojos Brillantes?
So Denver had a band called Intramural, and he reached out to me, and I wrote a song, or it was sort of based on the Postal Service method of, like, he sent me a bunch of beats and sounds, and then I wrote some lyrics and put some guitar and stuff on it and sent it back, and it came out.
Was it in Spanish?
It was not.
Was it Chiquitita by ABBA?
Because Desaparecidos was not what this was. It was a side project.
It was El Intramural.
That's right. That is a little bit of a side bar.
Not at all. I think that's right down there. That's what people expect to hear when they listen to Omnus about soccer.
Well, we haven't gotten to soccer yet.
But I believe.
You believe the children are our future, and you believe that soccer will show up in this episode. So the The Falklands War was precipitated by a Argentine invasion of the islands, partly because the latest and last leader of the junta, a general by the name of Galtieri, was suffering from low ratings and economic crisis, and a lot of people
This is how the movie Network starts.
About all of their relatives being taken up in airplanes and thrown out the door. And
the cool thing about Argentina is all the military dictators can have like Italian names if you want, or German names. Like the next guy might have been called Kretschmann. You don't even know.
That's right. Argentina in all its many splendors.
It's a rich melting pot.
But nothing excites a bunch of angry people who are suffering from military dictatorship
and massive inflation.
And massive inflation, like a war with a larger country halfway around the globe for possession of some rock strewn. Windswept islands.
Yeah, I think we should try it if inflation continues in the U.S.
Interesting. What
we should invade
Nova Scotia.
Exactly. The Atlantic provinces always should have been ours, and everyone knows it.
Hear, hear. Actually, that is kind of a good that would be a good like campaign promise.
Isn't it the premise of the movie Canadian Bacon?
Is it?
Yeah, President Alan Alda is things are not going well, and so he. I can't remember where he invades.
Canadian Bacon, another film you've seen and I haven't, because it was on a list of films that you made to see that I did not.
That was me wandering around a Blockbuster in 1989.
Anyway, so to just summarize, the Argentine government, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines invaded the Falklands, and now the UK government was put in a hard position.
We don't want it either, but we can't have this.
Yeah, we can't allow this.
We can't have this.
And Margaret Thatcher, the Hand of God, the Iron Lady.
The Hand of God, as we call her, as we all said.
She saw this as a great opportunity to do the, to make the conservative case that... that
Britain was not a declining power.
That's right, one Britain. And so they sent a big flotilla down, and it was kind of the first... real war where cruise missiles, famously the Exocet missile, like these airplane to ship missiles, really came into effect. Like there hadn't been a ton of naval battles.
Did Argentina have any?
They did.
Theirs were mostly airplane to water, probably not airplane to ship.
Well, and they had a lot of Argentina had a lot of modern weaponry. And they did sink some British ships and shoot down some British planes.
Early in the war, that was a real wake-up cry. That's not the expression.
It's a wake-up cry.
As we all say, it was a waking cry. A rally-up
the
point.
The old rallying wake-up.
The wake-up call to the British when suddenly they were cheerily waving at their flotilla heading across the Atlantic only to see it sunk.
Yeah.
What a bummer.
And it was a long, Argentina's a long way from England. And also the southern islands are even a long way from Argentina. So, or at least any part of Argentina you'd want to be. And Argentina was actually in a kind of, a real kind of contest that almost led to war with Chile over some islands in that same archipelago that were in contention between the two.
That's the other thing I learned in Argentina. To this day, a little tense with the Chileans.
Oh, yeah. It's just like Greece and Turkey, except there's no one there in those islands.
It's like the U.S. and Canada, except there's no Alan Alda making trouble.
It's guano. That's what it is. The real resource there is guano mines.
You got to get all that guano.
So big battles, lots of people died. In the end, the Argentines were defeated. The lion's share of their army was captured.
We should have just jumped to this, to your two-syllable precis of the Falklands War. Anyway, a lot of people died and Argentina lost.
The end. And
war is hell.
And the war made Margaret Thatcher and her conservatives popular in the UK.
They could close so many coal mines.
Yeah, it was remembered, all the flag wavers waved their flags. And as you have said, in Argentina, it was never forgotten, still not forgotten, still a sore thorn. A sore thorn, as we say.
That famous expression, a sore thorn in the paw of the Pampas.
That's what it is.
I've said this on the show before, but I've been in Ushuaia, Argentina, which would be the capital of the province to which the Malvinas belonged, were they actually Argentine property. And all the flags and plaques and maps and stuff you see on civic and municipal buildings all have maps of the Falklands prominently displayed, as if to show proof that they are part of that part of Argentina.
That's all you need. All you need, as we know.
Maybe they should have shown Margaret Thatcher that plaque I saw in Ushuaia. And she would have been like, well, I had no idea.
And there are memorials right and left in both Argentina and the UK, statues of valiant soldiers. And in fact, after the war, there was a new interest on the part of the United Kingdom to really make the Falklands into something.
Super British.
So they built
all food there has to be pureed there for 10 minutes before you take a single bite.
That's right. Boiled potatoes imported from Ireland.
Mr. Bean is now the president.
No, they built a big airport there because they realized, oh, we need a big airport there if we're going to fight battles from here.
We can't just keep sending battleships.
But a big port, you know, they turned it into somewhere because they'd fought for it and might as well.
Sunk costs.
The rivalry between the United Kingdom and Argentina goes back before the Falklands War, however, and primarily expressed on the soccer pitch, or the football pitch, as we say.
El campo de fútbol,
sí,
as they would say in Las Malvinas.
Sí.
So
they wouldn't say that in Las Malvinas because everyone there speaks English.
Oh.
But they would say it
I'm speaking to a future generation for whom Argentina has reclaimed their rightful heritage. Are you saying their cultural war started in international soccer games? Like, are they a World Cup enemies?
Well, you know, soccer, as we say here in the United States, and I hope our international listeners will forgive us for not saying football.
We'll say association football.
Was spread around the world primarily via the engine of British colonialism.
Mm-hmm. And the same way they tricked us into cricket.
They didn't trick us into cricket.
By us, I mean...
Oh, them.
I mean non-British people.
Oh, I see. The rest of the world. Yeah, that's right. And Argentina is no different. Although never a British colony, there were a lot of British settlers there during the 19th century, and they brought their game of football, and it was in its early iterations thought of as an English sport and gradually sort of caught on in Latin America as it did the rest of the world. And it was it was kind of a sea change over time. Initially it was a sport played by this country club set, and then the following year, there were more Argentines on the team. And then, 10 years later, all of a sudden, Argentinian football became its own sport. And then intra-South American leagues. And it took decades. But
Argentina still remains like maybe the biggest, well, with Brazil, I guess, the biggest reliable soccer powers in that hemisphere, in our hemisphere.
Yes, but it really only kind of took on a global stature in the 1950s. The first time that Argentina played Britain, or I'm sorry, England, I should say. Now, we're not talking about Britain now. We're talking about England.
I mean, they could easily beat Wales, but...
The first time they played England was in 1953, I think, at Wembley Stadium. They were the second team to play England after Scotland.
Ever to play? Because international soccer. Oh, at Wembley.
Yeah. International soccer was just beginning to be a thing at this point. And then the English team came to Buenos Aires and they brought their second string team played against the first string Argentinian team.
We're condescending.
In front of 91,000 spectators. Yes. A huge game. This is in the 50s. And then I think, realized that they needed to bring their first string team. And I think beat the Argentines, but they were, but this was a source of a lot of Argentinian pride to, or maybe it was a draw. That's the thing that's so crazy to me. We don't have any sports here in America that can end in draws.
Presidential elections.
Presidential elections often end in draws. It's
the only one.
So it's never clear to me how you can have a sport where up to 50% of all the matches, I mean, there's no reason it couldn't be 90%, end in ties.
They love it.
They do.
It just gets their blood pumping. So a good 1-1 tie on the pitch.
They played against each other between 1951 and 2005. The UK and Argentina played 15 games total against one another on the international stage. The UK has won 6 of those, Argentina 4, and 5 draws. So, and I think one of those draws even was like one of those UK victories was decided on a penalty kick. So, I mean, it's a pretty close matchup. But there have been a couple of massively political games over the years. The first one in 1966, a game that is described...
That's the year that England won the World Cup, right?
Yes, and this was a quarterfinal game in the World Cup that is known as the theft of the century.
Probably not in the UK.
In the UK, it is not known as the theft of the century, or in Spanish, el robo de siglo. Siglo.
Siglo, that's right.
El robo del siglo.
That's pretty confident, knowing that for the next 34 years, there will not be a bigger robo.
It's of the century, right? So many robos that happened after 1966, but...
Unless they're saying that's the biggest robo between 1866 and 1966. Right.
Could be, or 1867, probably, to leave a little bit of wiggle room.
That's correct.
But in the game, Jeff Hurst was...
Of Argentina.
Good old Jeff Hurst, spelled G-E-O-F-F.
G-off.
Famous Argentinian name. He was offsides and scored a goal and was not called for offsides, which he was clearly offsides, and the Argentines were furious about it. And then... the Argentine captain, Antonio Ratten, was given... This was right before yellow cards and red cards were issued.
Oh.
They were given cautions instead before yellow and red cards, which I think this was an example where there needed to be some explanation of the difference between a yellow caution and a red caution.
Like this guy should have been thrown out?
Well, he was thrown out. Antonio Ratten was given a second caution and then ejected from the game.
Oh, but in the eyes of Argentina, prematurely.
Well, prematurely and unfairly. But the reason is that Ratten was, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Ratin. That
sure
would be the
it's
French
not French. Way. What is it, R-A-T-I-N?
R-A-T-T-I-N.
That's probably Ratin.
He was arguing with the ref, but he didn't speak English and the ref didn't speak Spanish. And he was calling for a translator, and the ref said that he didn't like the way Ratin was looking at him, or he didn't like his face somehow. The ref was German, and so he ejected him from the game. Well, he wouldn't leave the field. And he had to be escorted off by the cops. And on his way off the field, there was the corner kick flags had little Union Jacks on them. And he walked by and grabbed one and like crinkled
it up. Oh, right,
because
this was in the UK.
It was in the UK.
Yeah, Britain won at home. That's right. England won at home.
Yeah, and then he sat down furious on the sidelines and wouldn't leave. And at the end of the game,
More like the temper tantrum del Siglo.
It was a little bit of a temper tantrum. The English manager, Alf Ramsey, said that they would not swap shirts.
Boo.
Which is a thing.
Yeah, you swap jerseys, right?
And he called them animals. And it was a major political, incident. So in 66, this this what had been kind of a friendly rivalry. You know, most soccer rivalries are like neighboring countries.
Yeah.
Brazil and Argentina have one, England and France, or I'm sorry, France and Italy, England and all of the other places in the United Kingdom that hate England.
So all of it.
The Dutch and the Germans, you know, the soccer rivalries aren't typically like across the world.
It's like U.S. sports rivalries.
Yeah, exactly. Like the Seahawks against the Raiders.
It's the team from your division, at least. Yeah.
Well, so that's the status of this rivalry going into the Falklands War. There's already a pre-existing kind of feeling that on the part of the Argentines that they have been not just treated unjustly, but rooked, like the theft of the century. Those are pretty strong terms. And little did they know the theft of the century was really going to be the Falkland Islands getting theft from them.
They named it prematurely.
They did. It's only a few years after the Falkland War, four to be precise, that Argentina and England are facing one another again and facing themselves. They're facing themselves.
I mean, isn't that what war really is?
It really is. 1986, the two nations are facing one another in the quarterfinal, the Federation Internationale Football Association. What does FIFA stand for?
Sure.
Let's call it that.
One of the F's is fraud for football.
Federation Internationale Football America.
Yeah, America.
almost to the week of the Falklands War,
like
4 years later,
okay.
In June of 1986, the two teams are facing each other in the quarterfinal. And this is the era of a soccer player who, widely known as one of the great soccer players of history, Diego Maradona.
The best in the world at that time.
The best in the world.
By pretty unanimous acclaim.
And I think, you know, one of the widely understood to be one of the best soccer players of all time. He is leading the team, and he's a very charismatic, he's a small-statured athlete who uses his small stature to be quick and kind of undefendable.
He's feisty. A lot of that's the cocaine, probably, but
he definitely has a lot of I read a description of the time. This was an era where the idea of an international superstar in soccer was kind of still a new idea. Pele had been the first, but there wasn't built into the international athlete culture, the kind of like levels of insulation that a rich person might be able to afford themselves now. I mean, you were extremely famous, but still also very accessible. And Maradona did not have handlers and didn't have people keeping him on a straight and narrow. And partly the reason we have those now is that we saw a lot of sports figures and celebrities crater pretty right. hard.
And also they don't want to meet the fans, really.
The fans. Am I right?
So what does that mean? A lot of people have stories about Maradona encounters or just that it was very easy for him to get in with shady characters.
He got into a lot of scrapes at one point in Italy. He was in Dutch to the mob. There were a lot of drugs, but he took on the character of a kind of madman, like a wild child that I think probably played pretty well in the newspapers then. And now there's a lot more insulation. You know, most of the American sports stars that have reputations for being wild children's, these days, that's not a winning strategy for them because it usually involves dog fighting or spousal abuse.
There's a movie that came out last year about Maradona's years playing for a club in Naples, and it's by Paolo Sorrentino. It's based on his own childhood as a Maradona fan in Naples at the time. And there is a scene where he sees Maradona like tooling down some little narrow hillside road in some kind of convertible or something. And everyone there is just like, you know, the premise of the movie is that it would change this kid's life if Maradona came to play for his favorite club, that it would be the biggest event in world history.
And it was. And
in Naples.
And it was, well, no, it was the biggest event in world history.
It was El Evento del Siglo.
It's why we all, every Sunday morning, go and anoint ourselves at the temple of Maradona playing in Naples. No, turns out it was not the biggest event in history. But this game did feature prominently in the events of history, the events of the 20th century. In the second half, score 0-0. Maradona is in the scrum.
Don't think there's a scrum, but okay.
It's a general term for any
metaphorical scrum.
English colonial sport. They all have scrums at one point or another.
It was the second chukka.
The ball's getting passed around. Steve Hodge from the English side kind of kicks the ball, trying to kick it out. They're fighting there in front of the goal. I'm not a soccer commentator, Ken. I don't know all the terms.
It's really coming alive.
They're down there by the goal and they're kicking it around and, you know, doing headers and other tricks.
Bicycle kicks, probably.
Mm-hmm, lots of those. They're sweeping the leg. They're doing all that stuff. Steve Hodge tries to clear the ball from in front of the goal, but he kind of miscalculates it and it actually goes in front of the goal. And the English keeper is a tall guy, Peter Shilton. He's 6'1", and he and Maradona are racing toward the ball. Maradona, being 5.5 feet tall, is pretty outmatched by Shilton in terms of, you know, getting to the ball in the moment. And Maradona jumps up as though to head it.
Still shorter than
as tall as the goalie. Yeah. And hits it with his hand into the goal. Just straight up swats it into the goal. But makes a little kind of makes the head motion of a guy heading it. And because at the time there was not the incredible television camera coverage of the field as there is now, although there were multiple views, it was not immediately apparent to the ref on the sideline, whose job it was to be watching, you know, he had the best sight lines, or the ref in charge of the field, or the commentators on television.
Really? So there wasn't immediate outrage.
No one officiating saw it. He just jumped up, hit it into the goal with his hand, and it looked like he'd headed it, and they headed it.
And it's not one of these where the crowd and all the English side knew that it was a handball, but the ref had somehow missed it. Because that kind of thing does happen in sports.
It was exactly that. Everybody saw it, including all of Maradona's teammates, the English, the crowd, but the English team and the crowd, but the ref. A Tunisian man by the name of Ali bin Nasser. So Ali bin Nasser was the referee in charge of the game, but the linesman was a Bulgarian by the name of Bogdan Dachev.
We're going to blame the Bulgarians for this?
And according to bin Nasser, Dachev would have had the better sight line, and in refereeing, you know, you defer to the person who had the best view.
I mean, if everybody's down there in front of the goal, it's very possible that anybody's view could have been blocked.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot to watch in a soccer game, and so the linemen may have been watching the cheerleaders, you know, soccer cheerleaders being very famous part of the game.
Huge.
But what happened was bin Nasser, you know, looked at Dachev, and Dachev did not make any kind of gesture. And so bin Nasser made his own call. Right, the assumption being that Bogdan, if he had seen a handball, would have flagged it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of, even to this day, sort of contention between the two.
Does Dachev say he did see it, or?
Well, Dachev says that Bin Nasser was inexperienced as a head referee, and that assistant refs were not allowed to challenge.
I see.
It feels very much like
they're covering their butts.
Yeah, a lot of passing the buck. Anyway, Maradona said at the time that as he ran, you know, he ran away from the goal doing that big celebration. You know,
he was selling it.
He was selling it, and he said, and as he ran across the field, none of his teammates were embracing him because they were all standing there waiting for the goal to get called back.
Uh-huh.
And he was saying, "Embrace me, you idiots! Like, if you don't look,
we sell it.
Yeah, we need to sell it." And so they did, and there was a lot of protest about it in the moment. The broadcasters, you know, the commentators, color commentators, thought that the issue, the reason that the English were standing around incredulous, was that they thought it was an offsides. And it was on the replay. It's such an elegant little handball that you could mistake it for, I mean, you could understand how they didn't see it.
To this day, is there any instant replay in international soccer?
Now there's an incredible system of, instant replay that basically eliminates the possibility of this. There are lots and lots of kind of legendary handballs over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Just as there are goals scored like that one in the theft of the century by players that are offsides. I mean, there's a lot of, refereeing plays a big part in soccer, and there are missed calls that have gone on to make historical differences in you know, teams that win.
There's something we should explain to the future, is that soccer is very particular compared to other sports, where in other sports where officials miss a call or blow a call, the official is criticized as having, you know, screwed up the outcome of the game. Whereas when this kind of thing happens in soccer, a move like Maradona's handball, or possibly even the offside non-call in the Robo del Siglo, the player himself is criticized as if he has somehow let the game down by committing a moral lapse. You know, like in American football, you would never see somebody hold a little on a decisive football play, and then, you know, if there was no call, the referee might get criticized for blowing it, but nobody would ever say this is a disgrace to the sport that Jones would attempt to hold like that. You know, in many other sports, the assumption is that the players will do whatever they can to get an edge. And, you know, in the rough and tumble of the field, that's going to include sometimes things that will be called as penalties, and that's the referee's job to call or not call them. But in soccer, very much, it's, Maradona was held personally responsible for this as if it were an immoral act that he would have to apologize for to the spectators, to the other players, to the game itself. And I think as an American sports fan, that's very hard to understand.
Well, and there are lots of other handballs in soccer that were where the...
Got a little rubber pencil action going here.
You were signaling me. It does look like that pencil's made of rubber. How crazy.
This is insane. How is it doing that?
There are lots of other handballs where the... the player, you know, was given that kind of unsportsmanlike criticism. In the Maradona case, the criticism all came from England and not really from anywhere else in the world, partly because Maradona was completely unapologetic. He fully did it. It wasn't an accidental handball. He fully did it. After the game, he was asked, did you hit it with your hand? And he said, the goal was scored a little with the head of Maradona, a little with the hand of God. But he almost immediately took the stance that this was retribution for the Falklands War, that England had stolen from Argentina, and that there was something noble in scoring this goal dishonestly.
Really, it's kind of small potatoes. It's a good deal compared to a whole archipelago.
He said that getting this goal in this way felt a little bit like stealing their wallet.
He's Robin Hood.
Yeah, although stealing their wallet is also a crime.
Not if you're robbing from the rich to give to the poor. He's from little underdog Argentina, although not in soccer. And he's gonna, he's a mischievous little kid.
Yeah, well, and I think the thing that saved him and the thing that made the Hand of God goal so legendary and spectacular, there were a couple of things. One of them was that Argentina beat the English team and went on to win the World Cup against West Germany. But also, not but a few minutes later, Maradona went on to score a second goal in the game, a goal known as the goal of the century.
Oh.
So between Argentina and England, we have the theft of the century, the Hand of God, and the goal of the century.
I feel like soccer fans have problems with grandiosity.
There's not at all. All of these things are accurate and level-headed descriptions of true facts.
But it was just some very, I don't know if I can picture the highlight. It's just some super impressive bit of soccersmanship.
It was a 60-yard dribble where he basically juked four different players in the most elegant kind of like start-stop way.
And it's just Maradona. He keeps it the whole time.
It's all he said later that he got the ball with the idea of setting up, he was setting up to pass to someone else, but he was too covered, and so he just had to keep going. And it's just exactly what you want out of soccer. As he makes his way down the field, he passes four different players. The run lasts 10 seconds, and he scores a beautiful goal.
Golazo.
He later said that he could only have done it playing against England, because every other team...
It fueled his anger?
No. He said every other team, somebody would have hit him.
Oh, I see. They were so... you mean after the previous incident?
No, that...
Just because that's good strategy.
In soccer, yeah, somebody would have fouled him.
To take the penalty.
But he said the English were the noblest players in the world, and they didn't... they played with such honor.
Is that a compliment coming from him?
Yeah.
Or is he sniggering?
No, he meant it as a compliment, but also, sniggering in the sense that he said, the way soccer is played now, somebody would have hit me.
So wait a second. Is the Hand of God goal irrelevant because Argentina won 2-0? Oh, no. England scored again in the 81st minute.
England scored again.
So it would have been that was the decisive goal.
Right. And England was on their way to scoring a second time. They almost made it into a draw, mm-hmm. which I guess is a thing in their sports. I still can't. It's just like, okay. They would have a runoff, right?
Which round of the World Cup was this?
This is the quarterfinal.
Yes, they would have been a shootout.
There would have been a shootout. But the English couldn't convert on their final play. So yes, it was the Hand of God goal was decisive, but Maradona proved that he was one of the great soccer players in the game just minutes later. So somehow that, I think, in the historical sense of that cheat,
he's redeemed because it's the highs and the lows at once.
Yeah, it is redeemed, although not from the standpoint of the English. There were
did they just hate Maradona until the day he died?
Peter Shilton never forgave him.
See, that's a funny thing to me that you would have to forgive your opponent for getting away with a foul.
Yeah,
because
Chilton was, is like a legendary goalkeeper and, was working on, I think, the record for the greatest number of saves. Mm-hmm. And because of this Hand of God goal,
wow,
he is tied for the greatest number of saves where he feels like he should have been.
So you couldn't write this any better. It seems suspiciously engineered as a Hollywood ending.
He should have had the legend. So this goal of the century is in Latin America famous as much for the commentary of the Uruguayan soccer commentator Victor Morales as it is for the goal.
Everybody is some famous call, just like the Giants win the pennant,
yeah.
or down goes Frazier.
It's one of those where, I mean, in researching this, I have listened to a lot of Spanish language shouting about soccer goals.
It's so great.
I've watched a lot of videos, and there's shouting, and then there's shouting. There's hysterical shouting, and then there's hysterical shouting. And Morales, you really have to listen to his soliloquy. He says in translation, "I want to cry, oh holy God, long live football." He's saying this at the top of his lungs, and then he says, "Cosmic kite, which planet did you come from to leave so many Englishmen behind for the country to be a clenched fist crying for Argentina?"
Wow. Do you think he had that all in the chamber ready to go?
I don't think so.
That's the poetry of his soul pouring out.
He's talking to the cosmic kite.
Cosmic kite.
"Which planet did you come from?" he asks of the cosmic kite.
And it seems like in this case, Maradona is the cosmic kite.
He is, yes. Or maybe the cosmic kite is the thing that Maradona flies upon.
Brought him to Earth.
But he really, I mean, honestly, I feel like if there's not a song already that samples his play-by-play, there ought to be.
I was just going to say that when Maradona died, like, Elton John should have recorded a song called Goodbye Cosmic Kite.
Goodbye Cosmic Kite. Well, Maradona just, Maradona died not that long ago, 2020. But this is an item that's ripped straight from the headlines.
How so?
Because in April of 2022, less than a month ago, based on when we're recording this show, although this show will air in July, right?
It will, or could 3,000 years hence, we don't
know. Or 3,000 years hence. After the 1986 game, in the tunnel leading from the pitch to the locker room, as is the tradition in almost every soccer contest other than the 1966 theft of the century, the players swapped jerseys, and Maradona swapped his jersey with player Steve Hodge, who was the player who had kicked the ball, you know, who had kind of poorly aimed the ball that ended up being
his fake header.
The fake header. He traded the jersey with Steve Hodge, and Hodge had held on to it. He let it be displayed for a time in a soccer museum, but he'd been encouraged to try and sell it. You know, there was a lot of interest in owning this jersey as an item of sports memorabilia, and as I say, less than a month ago, the Maradona jersey sold at auction for £7.1 million.
This is the one Maradona gave Hodge.
The one Maradona gave Hodge, which of course a lot of people were like, it's not the real one, but Maradona actually confirmed in his autobiography that he did give it to Hodge. And so it's now the most expensive piece of sports memorabilia that there is.
Wow. And that concludes The Hand of God, entry 565.JB1921, certificate number 38221, in the omnibus. Futurelings, in our time as we recorded this entry, John and I were on social media at Omnibus Project, respectively at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick as individuals. You could email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Please correct all of our misapprehensions about world soccer. Please explain to us the beautiful game and its superiority to all other international forms of football. Please send us physical items. Send us a £7.1 million soccer jersey. Hedge fund guy, if you're sick of it.
Please do.
We will. How much will we offer for it? Like, all his NFTs have crashed now, and we will offer you $20 American for your Hand of God jersey, you can send that to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. The best way for others who don't own that jersey to support the show would be to go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and consider becoming a supporter. Maybe some of you have listened to all 480 episodes and you need more content, in which case joining at the lowest tier actually delivers you access to our back catalog of addenda shows. We're now up to, I don't know, a few dozen?
Yeah. Well, yeah. More than 25, right? 25?
Maybe? Are we getting up towards 30? I don't know. The monthly addenda shows we've been doing.
They're wonderful. We really have such a good time. Not like the drag that this show is normally to listen to.
we appreciate you sticking it out for this one, but the addenda shows really move.
Yeah, we really have a gas over there.
So make sure you check that out. Become a supporter. And look for other like-minded futurelings to argue with soccer about by finding futurelings on Facebook or Reddit or, you know, whatever, TikTok.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. Ken is making his pencil rubber.
It's a Cat in the Hat pencil. It has thing one and thing two.
And it's working pretty well.
And the two humans, I can't remember their names.
You know, I don't know if you're tripping yourself out, but you're tripping me out.
Getting trails.
Wow. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all the recordings, may have been our final word. If that's the case, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope you come see us all. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.